But then, maybe I don't.
Her husband was winding tighter and tighter the longer Will remained out of contact. But it wasn't just that. He'd found something to occupy himself, some puzzle or question he was trying to work out, and it was making him crazy. He was intently focused on the news, watching and reading. Pieces of scrap paper covered with notes and numbers and circles and arrows were accumulating on every flat surface in their home. It all had to be Oracle-related. Everything he did these days was Oracle-related. But so far he hadn't seen fit to explain. He just got more and more stressed out with every article he read. Miko ran a fingertip over the edge of the envelope in her purse. Its contents might make things better, but they could also make things worse, and she wasn't sure which way to go with it. Hamza was brilliant, but because he was brilliant, he assumed that no one else could see the things he saw. And maybe that was true. No one saw everything he saw, but people could see some of it. For instance, she was very aware of how bad it could be for her, him, and their unborn child if the Oracle was outed. The disaster in Uruguay after the murder of Jose Pitaluga made that point crystal clear. When it came to the Oracle and anyone connected to him, emotions ran high. This was why she'd held onto the envelope for a few days. Maybe it was better if the Oracle was out of their lives. But then again, maybe it was better if he wasn't, so they could at least exert some influence on his choices. Hamza was sitting at the kitchen table when she walked into their apartment, one hand buried in his dark hair, the other holding a pencil with its tip poised above a yellow legal pad covered with the familiar circles, arrows, and angry scratch-outs. A tablet lay next to the notepad, showing some sort of article. Miko walked over to him, kissing the top of his head. She saw what looked like an offshore oil platform on the screen, surrounded by dense columns of text. "Hi there," Miko said. Hamza set his pencil down and looked up at her. "Hi," he said. "Can you sit down? I want to tell you something." Miko, instantly wary, took off her coat and slung it over the back of a chair, dropping her purse beside it as she sat. "Did you figure it out?" she said, gesturing to the notepad. "Whatever it is you've been working on?" Hamza glanced down, frowning. He took a few long, deep breaths, then looked at different parts of the kitchen, then down at his notes, then finally back up at her. "I don't know. I want to see what you think." He tapped the tablet screen, indicating the oil platform. "You see this?" he said, swiveling it on the table so she could read it, and then, unsurprisingly, leapt in before she could get through more than a paragraph. "Transpipe Global, GmbH, oil company. This article's about one of their drilling platforms off the coast of Uruguay. Yesterday it was nationalized as part of the declaration of martial law." "Okay," Miko said. "And?" "Transpipe is one of our clients. Like, ours. You know." Miko nodded. She did. An Oracle client. "We made like $200 million off them, back at the beginning. Will sold them a prediction that caused them to expand their exploratory drilling on their platforms. They bet huge on it. Transpipe isn't enormous as oil companies go. This was a big play for them. All their eggs in one basket. And now they are completely fucked. Those eggs are broken. Or more accurately, now they belong to Uruguay." Hamza now spun the notepad toward her and tapped his pencil on the first circled element, which Miko could now read as containing the word actor. "It would never have happened absent two things. Will putting up the prediction about Pitaluga on the site, and the Oracle selling a different prediction to Transpipe. We did them both." Miko read through the notepad, seeing the path. She looked back up at Hamza. "Don't you think it's just a coincidence?" she said. "No one knew about your deal with Transpipe. You told me all those clients paid most of their money to you to keep the prediction secret. No one could have known that the prediction about the actor would end up with martial law in Uruguay. Coincidence." Hamza repeated his routine of looking everywhere in the room but at her, then finally took back the notepad and flipped it to the next densely covered page, tapping his pencil against the yellow paper.
"I don't know, Meeks," he said. "Even if Transpipe doesn't completely collapse, this has thrown a ton of instability into the markets. No one knows what Uruguay will do with that oil, if anything. Gas prices are starting to spike. It's getting all wibbly-wobbly out there, globally."
"So," Miko said, "this is like the thousandth time you've told me a story about the market falling or rising or hedging or calling. Why is this different?"
"Because it kind of feels to me like maybe someone planned it."
"You mean Will did this?" Miko asked. "Why would he?"
Hamza laughed, bleak, worrisome. "Will couldn't have done this. Not in a million years. He doesn't know anything about the way global financial markets work. And planning something like this, you'd need a thorough understanding of all the pieces. Not just oil, but old political stuff in Uruguay. The way their society works. Will's smart, but he's a musician, you know?"
"Okay then, like I said, it's a coincidence," Miko said. "No one could know all that."
"They could," Hamza said, absently doodling on the notepad, his gaze distant. "With hindsight."
"I thought the predictions don't mean anything, Hamza. There's no big plan, no purpose behind it all."
Hamza's eyes snapped back to meet hers. He looked afraid.
"Miko, what if I'm wrong?"
Miko considered. Part of her wanted to run as far as she could from anything connected to the Oracle or Will Dando. But another part, apparently larger, wasn't sure that would do any damn good.
"You need to tell this to Will," she said. "Talk to him in person. You both need it."
"How?" Hamza said, spreading his arms in frustration. "I don't know where the fuck he is." Miko reached down to her purse. She pulled out the envelope and tossed it down on the table, where it landed between them with a muffled slap.
"Now you do," she said.
"What?" Hamza said, confused, looking at the envelope.
"Uruguay," Miko said. "Will's in Uruguay."
Hamza let out a long sigh. "Yeah," he said. "Of course he is."
Chapter 20. A sign hung on the door to room 918. "Por favor, no molestar," with the English equivalent printed below it.
"Uh-huh," Hamza said.
Hamza rapped his knuckles against the door, hard enough to hurt a little, making a sharp noise in the otherwise empty hallway.
"Can you come back later?" came Will's voice through the door, muffled.
"No, Will, I can't," Hamza said loud. "Open the goddamn door."
A long pause, and then the sound of latches releasing, deadbolts chocking back, and a low creak as the door opened, revealing Will Dando's very surprised face. He looked like he'd just woken up, hair sticking up in greasy clumps. An overall vibe of groggy unwashedness.
"Hamza," he said, "how the hell did you find me?"
"I didn't," Hamza answered.
He turned and pointed back down the hallway.
"She did."
Will moved forward, looking in the direction Hamza indicated, to see a slim, lovely woman whose belly showed the faintest curve. Nothing that anyone but her husband would ever notice.
"Hi, Will," Miko said.
Will's head turned slowly to look at Hamza. His face was almost blank.
Does she?
"Yeah," Hamza said. "Everything."
Will looked down, his fists slowly clenching, his forearms trembling with the strain.
"I can't believe you fucking told her," he said,
then turned and stepped back into his room, leaving the door open. Hamza opened his mouth to shout out a reply, then felt a hand on his arm. He looked and saw that it was Miko, her face pale but composed.
"We don't know," she said. "We don't know what he's been dealing with. It's all right. Let's just talk to him."
Hamza nodded and entered the hotel room where Will had been living. He stopped, shocked. It was a sty.
Unmade bed, half-eaten trays of room service, empty beer cans and bottles, towels and papers scattered across every surface. Behind him, he heard Miko follow him in and close the door. Will was waiting, staring at him, his face dark.
"Jesus, Will," Hamza said. "This is a hotel. They'll clean up for you. This is just filthy."
Will glanced around the room. He shrugged.
"They won't clean while I'm in here, and I don't want to leave. I paid for a month in advance so they won't bother me."
Hamza thought about this.
"You've just been in the room?"
"Mostly. Bad things happen sometimes when I go out there." Hamza also thought about this, then looked at Miko. She shook her head slowly, helplessly.
"How did you figure out where I was?" Will asked Miko.
"It was easy, Will," Miko said. "I hired a PI, told him to look for hits on the name Will Dando in places you might go, with Oracle-related stuff high on the list. He found you here, and then Hamza bribed the desk clerk for your room number."
Hamza stepped forward.
"You are not safe, Will. You are not anonymous."
"Oh, I'm safe. Trust me on that."
"But why? Why did you go to all that trouble?"
Hamza looked at him in disbelief.
"Will, I haven't heard from you in 6 weeks. No calls, texts, emails. Why the fuck do you think I've been looking for you? I thought you were dead."
His voice cracked. He turned away, pushed a pile of dirty towels and old newspapers off a chair and sat down. Will collapsed onto the bed. He was looking at Miko, his face tight.
"Is it really so bad that I know you're the Oracle, Will?" she said.
"I mean, at least you'll have someone other than my husband to talk to about all this, right? I mean..."
Will's face relaxed a bit, the side of his mouth twitching upward.
"Heh," he said. "Yeah, he's no picnic."
"Don't I know it?"
Miko said, smiling. Hamza watched this exchange, marveling, as always, at his wife's ability to smoothly navigate situations that he would manage with brute force, assuming he could manage them at all.
"I'm not mad that you know, Miko," Will said. "I'm afraid."
Will ran a hand through his hair, resulting in a brand new clump pointing toward the ceiling. He flopped down on the bed, threatening to upset a tray of half-eaten food sitting on the fumbles of sheet and bedspread. He reached out and grabbed a half-eaten piece of toast from the room service tray.
"Oh, Will, that looks like it's a week old," Miko said. "Don't eat..."
Will crunched down on the toast, chewing absently.
"I didn't mean to, you know, drop off the grid," he said. "I just needed some time. I was getting overwhelmed. I went to Florida, and then I just decided I'd come down here to see Jose Pitaluga perform. No big plan, just, a whim. I was there in the theater when it happened, when he was killed. I took the concierge with me. And I stayed, while the country went nuts. You know, people here are all freaked out about it? Uruguay's supposed to be a stable country. This is very out of character for them."
Will looked at the piece of toast in his hand, apparently considering a second bite, then tossed it back on the tray.
"I put up those warnings on the site, and I saved people, sure. But people just keep dying, don't they? It's like a tennis game. The site kills some people, so I save some people. And then the site kills some more. Back and forth, back and forth."
"So why is it still up?" Hamza asked. "We have an exit plan. We can take it down whenever we want."
"It wouldn't make any difference. I've already put so many predictions into the world. You think people would just forget them if I took down the site?"
"No. None of them are going away, ever.
Whatever's going to happen because of those predictions is going to happen. Taking down the site wouldn't change anything. It'll do what it wants."
Hamza looked closely at his friend.
"You just referred to the site like it's alive, Will. Twice. Why did you do that?"
"Because I think it is, Hamza. In its own way."
Hamza considered. A week ago, he'd have taken this statement as evidence that Will had finally cracked under Oracle-related pressures. But now,
It sounded pretty goddamn plausible. Things went nuts down here after Peter Luga died. I couldn't really go anywhere for a while. It was too dangerous even to get a cab to the airport. So I just stayed here, and I watched it all happen out the window, and I thought. And sitting there, watching things burn and hearing gunfire and knowing I was a part of it, I ended up asking myself a question, over and over again. He looked at Hamza and Miko, his eyes hollow. Whoever or whatever is the source of the Oracle dream can see the future. Or they're in the future looking back, whatever. So? Will gestured toward the window, in a sweeping flail of his hand that Hamza took to signify the chaos in the city beyond. Couldn't they see all this coming? He dropped his hand. And if they could see it, then why would they want it? Why wouldn't they try to stop it? Hell, the site gave me that prediction. The site caused this. It wanted it. And everything else that's happened since I put it up. Will stood up suddenly. A half-full glass of water on the room service tray teetered and fell, adding to the mess. Will ignored it. He stood up and walked across the room, bending to rifle through the pile of newspapers and printouts Hamza had shoved to the floor when he sat down. "I had a system for this," he muttered. He pulled out a sheet of paper, then discarded it. "I've been trying to understand why the site's doing what it's doing," Will went on. "What it wants. I don't have all the pieces yet. I'm not really built for this. It's all over the place. Economics, politics, all kinds of things. But I think I see some of it. None of this is random. I didn't get the predictions just so you and I could get rich. Something else is happening." Hamza took a deep breath. He thought about men with guns, and the sandbagged checkpoint he'd had to cross to get into the hotel, and riots at the Oracle rallies, and the near-constant attacks on the site from governments all over the world, and the lucky corner, and several $1 billion, and Miko and his child. He held his breath, not sure that Will was ready for what he was about to tell him. Not sure that he was ready to know it.
"Tell him, Hamza," Miko said.
Will looked at him, curious.
"Tell me what?"
Hamza exhaled.
"I know what it wants," he said.
Will paused his paper shuffling and looked up at him.
"Please, Hamza, don't tell me there's nothing here. Don't tell me I'm too worked up about this or some bullshit like that. I'm not. This is real."
Hamza reached out and put his hand on Will's shoulder.
"I know," he said. "Just listen."
He spoke. He described the connection he'd found between Peter Luga's death and martial law in Uruguay, and the nationalization of the Transpipe offshore operation. He talked about the way these things had affected the global economy, the precision and foresight needed to engineer such a chain of events, and his strong belief that it almost had to be intentional. Will went very still.
"Well," he said. "It's all true," Hamza said. "I know it sounds impossible, but I think that's what the site was doing this whole time. I don't understand why, but..."
"Heh," Will said. "Transpipe. I missed that one." Hamza narrowed his eyes.
"What?"
he said.
"Right in front of me," Will said. "Right out the damn window. Should have seen it."
He bent back to the pile of papers and pulled out a single sheet. Something that looked like a heavily annotated list. He folded it and shoved it in his pocket, then stood up. He turned and walked to the door, slipping his feet into a pair of sandals.
"Come on," he said, and left the room.
Hamza and Miko looked at each other, but there wasn't really anything to be said. The elevator ride was silent. Miko reached out and took Hamza's hand, and they rode down all 10 floors that way, with Hamza regretting involving Miko more with each floor they passed. The doors opened, and they stepped out into the Hotel Carrasco's ornate, nearly empty lobby. Will headed for the hotel's exit, avoiding eye contact with the many security guards stationed strategically throughout the huge open space, guards armed with automatic rifles, in uniforms that were one flag patch away from full-on military fatigues.
A few members of the staff milled around, attempting to look like they had something to do in a city that had been depleted of luxurious travelers by a declaration of martial law. A lovely young woman at the concierge desk looked up, hopeful, but dropped her eyes as soon as she saw Will. Hamza wondered fleetingly if Will had somehow taken her to the Petaluga thing. Will pushed through the revolving doors and out into the plaza beyond. Miko tugged Hamza's hand, pulling him to a stop.
"How is he?" she asked. "Because he seems bad."
Yeah, he said, feeling entirely helpless. Miko gestured at the revolving doors.
"Let's go."
Will stood on the wide plaza in front of the hotel near a large, sparkling fountain. The white sand of the Playa Carrasco was visible past the heavy traffic on the double-lane road between the hotel and the beach. The Rambla República de México, and the dark, sun-dappled sea beyond. The fountain provided a light, tinkling accompaniment to the breeze coming in off the beach. It was all very inviting, if you ignored the military emplacements.
"Before I say anything," Will said, "especially because of that," he pointed at Miko's belly, "I want you to know that I think you both should get as far away from me and the sight as you can. Stay out of it. This isn't your problem, it's mine. You've already done so much for me. And if you want to go, this is the right time to do it. I won't be angry."
Will folded his arms and looked back out at the sea.
"You're better off in the dark," he said. "I mean it."
Hamza turned to look at his wife. A long moment, and then Miko gave a little nod.
"Tell us," Hamza said.
Will sighed.
"Okay. There's something happening with the site," he began. "It's not just Transpipe and that one prediction about Petaluga. It's all of them. The predictions are connecting. They're..."
Will stopped and took a breath.
"The predictions are working together. I don't know how else to say it," he said simply.
Neither Hamza nor Miko spoke for a moment.
"Can you try?"
Miko said slowly. Will looked at the fountain, its basin full of clear water shining in the sun. He reached into his pocket and pulled out a few coins, then held one up.
"Okay. I release a prediction, either by putting it on the site or selling it."
Will tossed the coin into the fountain. Circular rings radiated out from the spot where the coin broke the surface of the liquid.
"Make a wish," Miko said.
"Oh, I did. Believe me," Will answered.
He pointed at the ripples.
"Things happen in the world because the predictions are out there. People do things they wouldn't otherwise have done. I'm changing the future."
Will took more coins and dropped them into the fountain, a few inches apart, one after the other. Each created a new set of ripples, which interacted with the tiny waves generated by the others. Interference patterns. Miniature geometries.
"There," he continued, "each prediction is a coin. It ripples out into the world, changing things. And sometimes those changes meet up with ripples from another prediction. They bounce off each other. And then something else happens."
Will splashed his hand across the surface of the fountain, breaking the patterns into chaos. He pointed at the roiling surface of the water.
"It's impossible to predict what will happen next, unless you're in the future looking back," he said. "Then you can see all of it. And then you send the information back to a person in the past who will use it how you want. He'll put some of it up on a website, sell another bit to an oil company. All of which you'd already know, because from your perspective, he's already done it."
Miko broke in.
"I know I'm new to all this, but just playing devil's advocate. Couldn't it just have happened randomly?"
Will pulled the folded sheet of paper from his pocket and handed it to Miko. "Read that," he said. Miko unfolded the paper. Hamza stepped closer, reading it over her shoulder.
"The chocolate milk fad, right?" Will said. "It was the most popular non-alcoholic drink in the country for the 3 months after the Oracle made a prediction about it. Everything else took a hit. Soda, iced tea, all kinds of juice.
including orange, grapefruit, all of that. But we told that hedge fund.
SWBG, Hamza said, not taking his eyes off the paper.
Right. SWBG. We sold them a prediction that made them invest heavily in citrus groves, expecting that the Florida frost in May will drive prices up. But with the chocolate milk thing, it went the other way. No one wanted orange juice for a while. Prices went way down, and SWBG had to pump in even more cash to keep things running. Even so, half of the groves went under. So did SWBG. They shut down last month. Between paying us almost $500 million and the bad investments, I guess they didn't have enough dough to keep the lights on.
I remember that, Hamza thought. The Dow dropped 400 points that day. But I didn't realize.
He looked up to see Will staring at him, calm.
This can't be possible, Hamza said.
I wish it weren't.
That list is what I've been doing down here. Researching, figuring it out. Those 14 connections are all I've found so far. But there have to be more that I just don't see, or that haven't happened yet. Like Transpipe.
That makes 15, I guess.
Hamza focused on the sheet of paper his wife was still holding. It was trembling.
I can't see the whole picture, Will said, tapping the surface of the fountain's pool with a fingertip,
watching rings radiate outward.
But I think the site's working toward 3 or 4 minor goals at the same time. Then, I think those things are supposed to come together too, to make something else happen. There's a tune to it, almost. Like a song with most of its tracks stripped away. Just the backing vocals and the drums and the horn lines. You know there's more.
So this is a puzzle? Miko asked,
her voice scaling up in pitch.
A game?
Not a game, Will said. It's more like one of those Rube Goldberg machines. Or, no, a giant engine. It feels like someone's out there driving all this forward.
What's it driving?
Miko asked.
If it's an engine, what's it pushing?
Will shrugged.
The world, I think.
And yes, he continued, I know I've never been the kind of guy who talks about stuff like this, even cared about it. But you'd be amazed how interesting it all becomes when you think you caused it.
He scooped his hand into the fountain, filling his palm with water, letting droplets fall back into the basin.
Will, this is insane, Miko said. We have to do something.
We can just step away, Hamza said. We have all the money in the world. The Coral Republic is almost done. I got a construction progress report for the Capitol building yesterday. All the other places we set up are ready. We can go with the exit plan.
Will opened his hand, letting the remaining water fall back into the basin, then stood up, wiping his hand on his shirt.
I think the site might be hoping we do, Will replied. I think that's why we got so many predictions we could sell. It's like the prize it's offering me so that I'll just disappear and let it get on with whatever it's doing. But I can't. I have to clean up my own mess.
He straightened, looking at them.
But not you two. I can't let you get any more involved than you already are. I mean it.
Miko shook her head.
You want to do all this alone? Will, for God's sake, you are about 2 days from storing your pee in jars up there.
I'm fine, he said, a little annoyed. You don't have to worry about me. Nothing bad can happen to me. Not right now. Not to the Oracle.
Will, that's ridiculous, Hamza said, his tone alarmed.
There is no Oracle, there's just you.
Sure, Will said. Listen, I can beat this, I know I can. I've been experimenting. Here, let me show you.
He turned and walked away from them, striding rapidly toward the busy street between the hotel and the beach.
Where are you going?
Miko called after him. Will didn't respond. Without slowing, he walked up to the side of the road, just a step away from the speeding flow of cars, motorcycles, and multi-ton trucks. And then he took another step.
No!
Miko shouted. Hamza sprinted toward the street, seeing in the corner of his eye that the soldiers at the nearest checkpoint had perked up at the disturbance. Any alarm he felt at that fact was swept away by the certainty that he was about to hear a squeal of brakes and a deep, meaty thud as his best friend was embedded deep into a semi's grill. He skidded to a stop at the edge of the street, catching a glimpse of Will striding across the Rambla República de México toward the beach, keeping his eyes straight ahead, as if he were walking across a lawn in Central Park, instead of a four-lane road packed with traffic speeding along at what looked to be an average of about 40 miles per hour. Horns blared, cars swerved, the soldiers in the checkpoint closest to the street unslung their rifles from their shoulders, trying to see what was happening. The light changed, the crosswalk cleared, and Hamza and Miko ran across to the beach. Hamza looked left and saw Will about 50 yards away, sitting on a bench, looking out at the sea.
"What the fuck was that, you idiot?"
Hamza said, shouting as he approached. Will looked up and smiled. It was an odd smile, empty and full at the same time.
"I told you. Nothing's going to happen to the Oracle. I'm completely safe," he said.
"That's crazy, Will," Hamza said. "That's just stupid."
"No, it's not," Will answered. "I still have predictions I haven't put out in the world. The site must want me to do something with them, and it won't let me die until I've done it. Those predictions are my insurance policy. I'm invulnerable."
Will's smile grew wider, too wide.
"I'm Superman," he said. He looked back out at the sea. "I'm going to beat it," he said. "I'm not just a tool for some spider thing, burrowing behind the walls of the world, making everything weak. I'm the Oracle. I can make things better."
"Stand up, Will," Miko said.
Will stood, the smile gone, his face suddenly unsure. Miko stepped forward, her arms outstretched.
"Don't say I," she said.
Will looked at her, confused. Miko enfolded Will in her arms, wrapping him in a tight embrace. Will awkwardly patted her between the shoulder blades.
"Damn it, Will, just hug me back," Miko said,
the words somewhat muffled by Will's chest. Will surrendered to the small woman's gesture and circled his arms around her. They stood like that for 30 seconds, while Hamza watched. Finally, Miko released Will and stepped back, sniffling a little.
"You need people," Miko said. "You might think you don't. You might wish you didn't. But no one can deal with all this alone. And since Hamza and I already know, and we love you, we're going to help you whether you want us to or not."
Will gazed at her.
"Let's go home," Miko said.
Part 3. Spring. Chapter 21. Will felt the pattern under his fingers, deep in the pocket, quarter notes locked in sync with the bass drum. Nothing he needed to think about, just a line to play under the solos, holding down his end of the song's foundation. He glanced at Jorge Cabrera, whose eyes were closed, his arms extended toward his keys as he entered minute 5 of his solo over the verse changes to the Talking Heads' Psycho Killer. He shifted his gaze to the audience, just indistinct silhouettes against the stage light shining in his face, although he could see Hamza and Miko sitting at a little table to the left. He sent them an entirely sincere smile. In the weeks since Uruguay, they'd both been pushing him, shoving, really, towards some kind of distraction from the endless effort to try to understand what the site was doing to the world. All three of them were working on it, studying news reports, making spreadsheets, but it just felt futile. The scale of the site's plan was obviously vast, a densely coordinated global effort, constantly in motion, evolving into something. And the team trying to understand that evolution, maybe even stop it, included a failed musician, a grade school teacher, and an ex-investment banker. It was like trying to play chess in a pitch-dark room, where you had to determine your opponent's moves by sense of smell alone. And you had a cold. And your opponent was God. Futile. But still they plugged away, dutifully studying the board, trying to win a game they didn't and most likely couldn't understand. Hamza and Miko had each other. They could share the weight of learning that the Oracle's predictions had almost certainly resulted in the rise of the Sojogaba movement in Niger, and the subsequent U.S. bombing campaign that was slowly but surely pulverizing that nation, in an attempt to destroy its leader while giving President Green a new hook upon which to hang his re-election campaign. Or the slow, endless downward spiral of the global economy. Or any of the other things the site was doing to the world. They could share that weight. Will was alone. His friends knew that, and they had concerns. Possibly justified concerns, after what they'd seen him do in Uruguay. And so they had gently suggested, then firmly suggested, then flat-out insisted that he find an outlet for his Oracle-related tensions. Which led to Will calling Jorge, and asking to sit in at one of his Sunday jam nights. They were always held at the same club, the Broken Elbow down in the village. A rotating cast of New York's musical elite attended, whoever wasn't on tour or booked somewhere, just to catch up with one another, trade gossip, and play a bit. Technically, anyone could ask to sit in. It was an open mic, but you got up on that stage at your peril. Jorge called a song, and the band played it, and that was it. No rehearsal, no prior discussion. If you couldn't hold up your end, no one would be a dick about it, but you were out of the cool kids' club, without much hope of ever getting back in. Playing at that moment were, among other luminaries, two musicians from the SNL band, and a guitarist who had laid down studio tracks for at least 3 top 10 singles in the past year. And Will Dando on the bass, holding down the line, sitting in that pocket. He felt light. He wasn't the Oracle. He was just a musician, on a stage with some of the best players in New York City, holding his own. The song wrapped up, clanging through the snarl of little guitar licks and drum fills and sax squeals that tended to end jams like this, culminating in one big punctuation mark hit on the snare. The 4 men and 1 woman on stage started removing their instruments, placing them on stands, trading nods and in-jokes and subtly joyous appreciation of one another's skill. Will turned to Jorge. Okay, if I do one during the break? Just something I've been playing around with. Want to see if it works with the audience. Jorge hesitated. This was a breach of etiquette. It wasn't an originals night, it was a covers jam. And moreover, no one was supposed to be featured. Even more, if someone was going to get a feature, Will Dando probably wasn't first on that list. But Jorge shrugged and clapped Will on the shoulder.
Sure, man, he said. Have fun. I'm glad you came out tonight. You've been missed. Not the same without you. Let's talk after, too. I've got some gigs I'd like to put you up for.
He gestured at the microphone at the front of the stage.
All yours.
Will moved to the center of the stage, pulling a few of his effects pedals over from his amp and arranging them in front of the microphone stand. He tapped a few, a loop, a thick layer of distortion, and some chorus, and tested the sound as the rest of the band left the stage and headed for the bar. A bark of snarling distortion whipped out across the club, fading into pedal-assisted echoes. Will could see the front rank of the audience lean back a bit all at once, as if they'd all been hit by a blast of Arctic wind.
This is a new song, Will said. It's about where things are for me right now.
Will began to play, thick, effects-driven chords rippling out from the amp, loud, grainy, and low, with a little melodic hook kicked in from higher up the neck every few measures. He sang, almost speaking, his voice intent and focused.
I don't speak to my family. They don't know what I know.
12 people gone, many more, many more.
You don't know what I know.
The song went on, Will's voice rising to a wailing lament, The final chorus, just a repetition of the words, "I know," over and over again. He finished, his eyes closed, the last note drifting out into the silent club. Applause, but scattered, barely registering over the background chatter. The room had taken the band's break as an opportunity to fire up conversations. Will didn't know why he was surprised. A lone bassist they didn't know playing a song they'd never heard? It barely qualified as entertainment. He was lucky they hadn't booed. Futile. Will began to play again. A short, repeated pattern. Just an appealing little anchor line. "How about the world these days, huh?" he said, talking to the room. "I've been paying a lot of attention to the news lately. More than I ever used to. Shitty out there, right? What's a gallon of gas these days, like $4? He played a little flourish, then settled back into the three-note pattern. "Here," Will said. "Let me give you what you want." The extinction of the Scarlet Kingfisher. A brawl erupts in the Taiwanese Senate over the issue of returning certain items of antiquity to the mainland. 12 people die during the commission of a robbery at the Lucky Corner Deli in New York, New York. A plane crashes in the Niger Desert 43 kilometers southwest of Tabelon. 14 infants are born at Northside General Hospital in Houston, Texas. 6 are male and 8 are female. Will could see screens appearing in the audience, people checking the site. To the left, he could see a silhouette, someone standing, body language communicating extreme tension. Hamza, most likely. He didn't care. Will opened his mouth to sing the next prediction, the one about the Malaysia Airlines flight, and his bass amp cut out. The robust, effects-assisted pattern he'd been playing immediately transformed into a thin, jangly skeleton of its former self. "Oh," he thought. He turned to look to the side of the stage, to see Jorge Cabrera standing with the sound guy at the mixing booth. Jorge's face was a little hard to read. The lights were still shining in Will's face, but he wasn't smiling. Will unslung his bass and leaned it up against his amp. "As if Jorge will let you back up to play again after that little adventure," he thought, and stepped down off the stage. He walked past Hamza and Miko, past Jorge and the other musicians, and found a seat at the far end of the bar. He ordered a beer and a shot. And as they came, he could hear Jorge on the microphone apologizing and promising the band would be up again soon. Will drank the shot and signaled for another, then began working to get through the beer before it showed up. A hand touched his arm lightly, and he flinched.
"Will," Miko said.
He turned toward her.
"Hamza wanted to tackle you right there on stage," she said. "I wouldn't let him. I thought it would just draw attention to what you were doing. That second one about the fight in Taiwan, you gave it to Hamza to convince him the predictions were real, right?"
"Yes," Will said.
"I remember that day. He came home early from Corman Brothers. Very out of character for him back then. Most days I barely saw him before midnight. He told me he was going to quit, and he didn't seem worried at all. Said he had something spectacular lined up."
She caught Will's eye.
"That was you. Turns out you were the spectacular thing, Will Dando."
"I guess so," Will answered. Miko went silent. Will watched her, wondering what she was thinking. In hindsight, it had been stupid to be so reluctant to let Hamza bring Miko into all this. She had dived into the work to figure out the site's plan with both feet, and she had a flair for making connections that neither he nor Hamza saw. More than that, though, she was kind in a way Hamza wasn't. She was thoughtful. She wanted to help. Will picked up the second shot and downed it. Miko was wonderful. "What did you think of the first song?" he asked.
"Grow up, Will," Miko said,
her tone mild. He looked at her, surprised. Wounded even.
"You aren't as special as you think you are. You aren't the only person who can see the future."
She reached out across the bar, sliding his half-empty pint glass away from his hands.
I'm a teacher. I see the future every goddamn day with those kids. Me and every other teacher out there. And then there's this.
She touched the swell of her stomach.
The future doesn't just belong to you. We all get our piece.
Miko's eyes narrowed.
I know how to deal with children, and so I've been nice. I've been sensitive. Because no one wants you playing chicken with a truck again, or jumping off a roof because you're convinced you can fly. But shit like that, she pointed at the stage, is absolutely not okay. You aren't allowed to implode. You'll pull me, Hamza, and who knows who else down with you when you go.
Will frowned. Children, he said.
Yep, Miko said. You are acting like a fourth grader. No, not even. Second grade tops.
You've seen what the site is doing, Will said, hearing the defensiveness in his voice and hating it. It's ruining the world, and I don't know what to do. I don't understand what's happening. I just know it's happening because of me.
So you decided to sing the predictions at open mic night?
Miko said, pointing back at the stage.
This isn't an open mic night, Will said, a little offended. It's invite only. It's actually sort of a big deal to play with these guys.
I hope you enjoyed it. I don't think they'll have you back anytime soon, Miko said, blunt.
Will sighed. He eyed his half-drunk, just out of reach beer.
You know, I talked to a priest, he said. Went to confession, for the first time since middle school. I didn't really have anything to confess, but I wanted to talk to an expert. Someone who knew about prophets. Had to be a little careful with my questions. Didn't want him to put two and two together.
What did he say? Miko asked.
He told me that prophets usually get killed. People don't like what God has to tell them, so they kill the messenger. Either that, or the prophet has to remove himself from society because he's scared he's gonna get killed, or because he just goes nuts from pressure. If you're a prophet, your choices are either to get your head served up to some king on a platter, or you can become a hermit for the rest of your life. Sometimes both.
I didn't know you were religious, Miko said. Do you really think the oracle predictions were sent by God?
Will turned back to her.
Not really. But that's the thing. I don't know. I mean, I'm a prophet by every definition I can think of. And when I hear about the way people talk about the oracle out in the world, decapitation seems very damn possible, you know?
Right. That's why you almost outed yourself to the whole damn bar?
No. It's because this whole thing's just too heavy. I guess I just wanted to get out from under it. We've decided it's our job to figure out what the site's doing, maybe stop it. I don't see how we can. It's not that you and Hamza aren't really smart. You are much smarter than I am. But this is all just on another level. The picture's too big for us to see.
You don't think that thing with, what was it? The Aberdeen will help us? I think that sounds pretty promising.
Will nodded. Sure, it might. Maybe. But even if it helps us understand, it's hard to think that one little thing will break the whole puzzle open.
So, what do you want to do? Give up?
Will took a deep breath. No, he said. I don't think we have to do this all by ourselves. I want to get help.
Miko's face turned puzzled.
Can you explain that?
Will pulled out his phone and turned it on. You know all those emails Hamza and I got in the beginning? The ones we used to find clients to buy predictions?
Yeah, Miko said. Hamza explained that whole thing. What about them?
I've been going through them in my spare time, answering one or two a day. Just saying something vague and reassuring. I didn't want people to think they were being ignored. I wanted to do something, you know? I've been giving money away, too, anonymous donations to charities. A lot of money. Don't tell Hamza. I'm sure he'd call it a waste or something.
Miko's mouth twitched up at one corner.
You're a good man, Will Dando.
Sometimes. Will held up his phone to Miko. It was displaying an image, a photograph of a sheet of paper. I found something in one of the emails that gave me an idea. I took a picture of it. I've been staring at it all day, just thinking about whether I should actually do it. Miko took the phone and zoomed in on the image. She looked up at Will, her eyes wide.
Wow, you don't mean...
Yeah, it could be a way to sort of crowdsource the sight puzzle. We'd have to be safe about it, but we could figure that out.
Miko looked at Will's phone again, shaking her head in disbelief.
You know, this could help with your other problem, too. It could humanize the oracle to the world. Make it less likely your head will end up on that platter. But my God, Will.
She glanced back toward the stage, where Hamza was visible, arms folded, silently watching them.
Hamza will hate this.
Chapter 22. Dr. Jonathan Staffman, former professor of computer science at the University of Pennsylvania, and self-labeled expert in illicit technological infiltration, stared intently at three glowing monitors set side by side on his desk. The middle screen displayed a Mercator projection map of the globe, the countries overlaid with an ever-shifting skein of yellow, green, and black, with pinpoints of red here and there. Most of the eastern seaboard of the United States was covered by various colors, while more sparsely populated areas like northern Africa were almost completely black. The monitor to the left of the map contained scrolling text readouts, changing rapidly as the colors on the map flickered and pulsed. The last screen to the right was a simple status bar with a percentage readout. The bar read 0.008% complete.
"Too much in Des Moines!" Staffman shouted. "Dial it back, goddammit!"
Iowa's capital was bright red. Over a period of about 10 seconds, it faded back to yellow, and then to green.
"Pay attention, Hernandez, you clown," Staffman said. "You should have caught that."
"I'm sorry, Dr. Staffman," came Hernandez's reply. "Won't happen again."
Staffman scowled and dipped his left index finger into an open jar of peanut butter on the desk. Jif Chunky. He pulled out a hefty gob and plopped it into his mouth, sucking on it as he examined the map. It looked suitably green, at least for the moment. The status bar ticked over another 1/1000%, 0.009%. Staffman grunted in satisfaction around his finger. He looked up from the monitors at the control room beyond. His desk was at one end of a large room with white walls, floor, and ceilings. It was arranged in a classroom configuration, with Staffman in the teacher's spot. 20 desks for students, each holding a computer setup similar to Staffman's, but with only 2 screens, not 3. At each desk sat a technician, occupied with monitoring a different section of the world. Staffman eyed his crew suspiciously. It was a solid group of coders, all hand-picked, but that didn't mean they could do as well as 20 copies of himself would have. This was delicate work, and if one of his subordinates screwed something up, the coach sure as hell wouldn't hold them responsible. Staffman turned his attention back to his screens, flickering his eyes across them for anything out of the ordinary, until he was momentarily distracted by movement in his peripheral vision. He looked up and froze. A large glass window took up most of the wall at the back of the room, where people could observe the goings-on in Staffman's lab, if they were so inclined. On the other side of that window, smiling, stood the coach. Staffman froze, his hand halfway through its journey back to the peanut butter jar. The woman made a motion toward the door with one hand, a sort of mind-if-I-join-you gesture. Staffman gave the coach what he hoped was a genuine-seeming smile, and waved for her to come in. She gave a hearty nod and disappeared from the window, entering the room a moment later and striding to Staffman's desk. A few of the technicians glanced up as she passed, then returned to their work when they saw it was just an old woman, hardly worth their notice. The coach wore a simple gray dress with a navy cardigan.
The expression on her face was the definition of non-threatening. Staffman felt like he was going to throw up.
Dr. Staffman, the coach said, forgive me if I don't shake your hand. I've got a pretty good idea where it's been.
Her gaze shifted to the jar of Jif, and she chuckled. Jonathan smiled weakly.
Tech team working out all right, the coach continued.
Yes, they're all good people. No worries there.
Good, good. Real glad to hear it. Now, Professor, tell me what it is you're doing. Looks like you've got something up and running here, the coach said,
turning the monitors on Staffman's desk slightly to get a better view.
Yes, Staffman said. That is, I think I have a way we can access the Oracle's systems.
Well, of course you do.
Although I seem to recall you told me that was impossible when we first started discussing this project. And what did I say, Dr. Staffman? Nothing's impossible. Not one thing.
As always, whenever the coach pulled out that little chestnut, Staffman was tempted to list any one of 100 things that popped to mind immediately that were, in fact, scientifically impossible. Surpassing the speed of light. A human mating with a crocodile. Proving the existence of God. But he refrained.
That may be true, coach, but there are things that are so improbable that they might as well be impossible. That's the real problem with the Oracle's systems. They're brilliantly organized. I can see the whole structure, but I can't get into it. Not easily, anyway.
He reached for a pad of paper and a pencil sitting to one side of the desk and drew 2 circles on it, of equal size. He labeled one with the word sight and tapped it with his pencil.
This is where everyone is focusing their attention. All the hackers around the world, big and small. Everyone wants to figure out the password to access the sight. To alter the text. Put up their own predictions, maybe. It's the most visible part of the system, and anyone who breaks into it will have bragging rights like no operator ever has. It's a big target. An obvious target, and it's well protected. I've seen this type of system before. The password is generated by a code phrase, and without that code phrase, forget it.
The coach made a get-on-with-it gesture. Her eyes focused on the second, as yet unlabeled, circle. That's how you could always tell what the coach really was. What she wore, how she talked. None of that was her. Her eyes, though.
But we don't care about the sight, Staffman said. We don't want bragging rights. We just want to see behind the curtain, to figure out who the Oracle is. That's why I'm putting my efforts here.
With that final word, Staffman moved the pencil tip to the second circle.
You see, he went on, the sight comes from the Oracle. It leads away from him out into the world. What we want is something that goes to him.
He wrote the word email inside the second circle and underlined it.
Somehow, somewhere, the Oracle is receiving all those emails. Must be millions by now. Hundreds of millions. That's an enormous amount of data traffic, which can be hard to hide. The email address is the soft spot, and that's where I'm hitting him.
He outlined the email circle several times, creating a thick, dark border around the word.
His people know it, too. The security around that email address is a big brick wall. Bricks made out of lead and steel, with big, scary spikes on top. Much heavier than on the site itself. Essentially unbreakable, at least in any reasonable amount of time.
The coach finally spoke.
But you just told me you got around all that. How?
Staffman laid down his pencil and looked up. I borrowed a concept from SETI. You know, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
I'm familiar with it. They aim antennas at the sky. Listen for messages from little green men.
Well, radio telescopes, but that's essentially correct. Their search produces immense amounts of information, space noise, if you will. All that needs to be processed to look for a potential signal. But it's not simple. It requires a great deal of computer power,
more processing than SETI's budget can afford by a long shot. So they appealed to the public. They offered a little piece of software for free to volunteers across the world. Once someone installed the software, SETI could use their computer as a node on their distributed network.